It's important as you think about the general election, as you think about what's happening here in Kentucky. You hold the people who ask for your vote accountable. I want you to hold me accountable.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. It is 5:09 and it is Wednesday. It's the 18th of May, 2016. Welcome to another edition of The Opening Bell. Welcome to another business day. We've got a lot to talk about today. A major study out about genetically modified crops. We'll have an interview with one of the researchers who put together the report coming up momentarily. Quickly, though, around the globe, here's your overnight market intel from the WGN Market Desk. As you heard Vic say, Asian shares mostly lower today after a dismal day on Wall Street yesterday. Tokyo shares were buoyed, but just a little bit by better than expected GDP data there. Growth in the first quarter was faster than expected. Yesterday, the Dow Jones Industrials fell almost 1%, 180 points. Today ahead, Federal Reserve releases minutes from its April interest rates meeting as investors worry the central bank could raise rates soon. That's what played into the markets yesterday, the Wall Street numbers yesterday. Fear of a rate increase coming at the June meeting of the Fed. A pair of positive economic reports yesterday led to a broad sell-off on Wall Street as well. Traders today will be looking over a pair of earnings report from Lowe's and from Target. The big news out of the world of agriculture and food today is yesterday's report by a scientist about genetically modified crops. The report, which has covered more than two decades and other years of study and other information, has determined that genetically modified crops are not only safe, they appear to be good for people and the environment. That was the report from the National Academies of Science. Also, they found something else about it. Apparently, they do not increase crop yields. Let's get right to our interview this morning. Standing by in Madison, Wisconsin, one of the authors of this study, Dominique Rossard. She's a professor and chair in the Department of Life Sciences Communication at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and a member of the National Academies of Science, and is with us via Skype this morning. Dominique, what has your study found? What are the major findings?
So the first thing that we wanted to make sure that was clear for any readers or listeners is that we found that this was a very complicated issue, and it was very hard to make sweeping generalized conclusion about genetic engineering crops overall. Right now, there are only two traits that have been extensively commercialized around the world, and that's herbicide resistance and BT. And with mainly three crops, canola, soybean, and corn. This being said, we look at the data related to those two traits and those three crops, and we found, number one, that although we concluded that there were some problems with some of the animal studies that have looked at the potential health effects of GE crops, overall, we couldn't conclude there was enough evidence to say that they were posing a risk for human health, particularly if you paired the accumulation of studies that have looked at that with epidemiological data that compared the incidence of cancer, autism, and other type of health effects in the United States with countries that have not been consuming GE crops, and that's mainly data in Europe. So that's something that we are quite confident about. The second thing that I think it's important to keep in mind is that the way we conduct our studies, to some extent a little bit unusual with the academies, because we started by what concerned a lot of potential, you know, people and consumers and stakeholders. And we use that as a starting point to investigate what were the areas that our report should include. And as a matter of fact, I think what's really interesting, by hearing a lot of different voices, we end up having a very, very, let's say, thorough picture of the multiple dimensions that needed to be addressed in this kind of report.
One of the other things that jumped out at me was, in addition to finding no real health problems, this did find
there was no sizable yield return from genetically modified crops.
Yeah, and that's an excellent point, because the report, you know, doesn't paint an extremely pink picture for GMOs, nor an extremely black picture of GMOs, and has, you know, like basically highlight that there are concerns as there are also potential benefits, right? And so basically we may make people that are polarized on both sides of the issue not very unhappy with us, but that's the reality of this issue. And the yield one is actually an important one to point out, because pro-GMO businesses have often said that, you know, this is a technology that is necessary to feed the world, right? And so that's why we look at closely at the potential yield increase. The way we did this is we looked at the rate of, yield increase in the United States, and looked at what was the slope to some extent of that increase. And what we noticed is that the rate at which yield was increased on average in the United States hasn't changed since the introduction of GMOs. And to some extent, this is not extremely surprising, because the traits that exist right now, as I was mentioning, you know, is to fight pests and the herbicide resistance, right? The BT and the herbicide resistant crops are basically traits that I've introduced to fight agronomical problems, right? So if you have a pest, you want to kill the pest. If you have a weed, you want to control the weed. So we don't have right now, and potentially they are in the pipeline, some traits that could directly be targeting yield increase. And I'm thinking of something such as, you know, drought resistance, or any abiotic stress, like, for example, making photosynthesis more powerful, things like that, right? That are not just agronomical problems. So these don't exist yet, and there's no data as far as how much they could increase yield. Overall, I would say we concluded that there's no, enough evidence to say that yes, indeed, GE crops are here, you know, linked. There's a cause-effect relationship between using GE and yield increase.
Dominique Brossard with us this morning from Madison, from the University of Wisconsin, a member of the National Academies of Science, which put together yesterday's GMO crop report. We'll get back to our conversation in just a bit.
From ABC News, Wall Street Now. The stock market roller coaster ended on the downside yesterday, the Dow Jones closing 181 points lower at 17,529. The S&P 500 gave up 20 points. The NASDAQ dropped 60. Benchmark crude oil rose to $48.50 a barrel. The Labor Department says consumer prices jumped last month by the most in 3 years, driven by a surge in the cost of gasoline. Aside from volatile food and energy, core inflation posted another modest gain of just 0.2%. More than 4 million U.S. workers will soon be eligible for overtime pay. The Obama administration is working to reverse what it calls an erosion of protections meant to ensure time and a half for people who work more than 40 hours a week. And Taco Bell goes upscale. Sleek, modern seating, exposed wooden beams, and trendy light fixtures will soon replace the neon purple glow that has long been associated with the chain. Taco Bell hoping to increase its evening sales. Jim Ryan, ABC News.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
Welcome back to the program, 521. Our conversation continues this morning about the genetically modified crops report out yesterday from the National Academy of Sciences from the University of Wisconsin. On Skype this morning, we're talking with Dominique Brossard, who was a member of the team that put that report together. Dominique, I'm interested to know, this found that obviously no health reports, but no yields either. What does it say about all of this moving forward?
It was a lot of work, but it was worthwhile. And also the type of process that we decided to embark on, which is to hear all interested parties with public meetings that had a wide range of stakeholders presenting, from obviously the big companies that develop those and commercialize those GE crops, to the concerned NGOs that have raised concern, to consumer groups, to also the regulatory agency, and so on. We had more than 80 presentations, 18 webinars that were, you know, open to the public, and more than 700 public comments that were submitted to us with different studies and so on. And so we review extensively all these materials. We end up with a report that has close to 1,000 references. That's close to 400 pages. So this was very extensive, a lot of studies to go through. And I'm proud to say that this is a consensus report. We are all signed on it, independently of what was a point of view when we started the process. 2 years, but I think, it's worthwhile. As somebody mentioned, I think it was on Twitter, that this is really the most exhaustive study on genetic engineering crop that has ever conducted.
You also sought out well-known anti-GE activists as well as people who are in the industry. So you feel like you got plenty of voices, different voices?
And that was, I think, to some extent, maybe unusual, because the way the National Academies conduct this kind of report is pretty clear. They say that we should consider all credible views on the topic, and then depends how you would, define credible. But we decide to actually define this in a way where people that have, an informed point of view, and that we needed to look carefully at what they had to say, and then look at the empirical data that may, sustain their point of view or not. There's something that's very important to keep in mind also as far as how we decided to conduct this process, is that we went back to a 1996 committee report that was called Understanding Risk, Informing Decisions in a Democratic Process, a Democratic Society. And what this report says, that we cannot just think of risk with just like technical assessment. That if you do that, just the technical and hearing only the ones that have that technical expertise, you may actually be answering, the wrong questions. So that's why we needed to open the process to all those point of views to make sure we're asking the right question, the one that, the American public and all concerned parties care about, not the one that the scientific community cares about, but the one all interested parties care about. So I think that's why it took a long time, and we had such an exhaustive review of the literature, but it was worthwhile.
And the other thing too is you're asking the public not necessarily to take your word for it. You've put all of this online so they can go and look for themselves.
You know what we really, what we really, really are hoping we achieve is to sustain a conversation, to start a conversation, so all those interested, they don't come with just their already made point of view, but they say, hey, these people spent 2 years, they didn't have any agenda, they're not paid, the study is funded by foundation, there's no link to industry, and, let's go and see what they found. And the way the report is organized online is like, we have the comments of the public that are listed, and you can click on a comment and you see how we responded to it. You can click on the findings and you can see what sustained, our finding, what's the evidence that we have found. For all the studies we cite, we actually went and looked at the affiliation of the first author and list all the funding information that we can find on the study, so people can make up their mind. And I hope see people find problems with the report, they would continue the conversation so this can be, thorough and participate in basically what we think a democratic conversation about complicated scientific issues have to be in the 21st century.
What might surprise people is that 90% of corn, soybeans, and cotton already in the U.S. are grown genetically modified. That surprised me.
I think it's something that a lot of the American public is not aware of. And as a matter of fact, we don't say this in the report, but I would say well established that close to 60% of the food on the grocery shelves contains some kind of a GE product because of, large reliance on corn syrup in processed food. And since corn syrup comes from GE corn and soybean also is GE, there's a really big probability that a lot of the food that we found in our main grocery stores contains some kind of GE-related ingredient.
The other thing is that in finalizing this report, your group has asked for transparency going forward, and that includes a stand on labeling for GMOs?
Well, what we said on labeling, like labeling is one of these issues that science alone cannot answer. So let's say for the FDA legal mandate, the Food and Drug Administration, there they can require labeling based on public health considerations. So if there is a concern about food safety, the FDA requires labeling, right? And in this case, we haven't found evidence that there was a health risk for the American public. Therefore, the FDA, you know, doesn't have grounds to require labeling. On the other hand, other authorities such as Congress or the state level can require labeling for other reasons. It could be, you know, the right to know. It could be a lot of different reasons that go beyond just the food safety. And what we say, this is a legitimate thing that can happen.
Do you understand that some consumers are going to always be leery of chemical companies like the ones that are mentioned most often that are associated with these? Is it right to be always sort of wary of those? Or at some point, do you have to believe what's put in front of you?
That's an interesting question, Steve. And I would never tell anybody that their perception is right or wrong. Perceptions are perceptions, right? And I think that what we may have right now is more an issue on trust on those information providers and potentially trust in the, you know, those that are supposed to make our food safe, right? And so I think to some extent, the ball is in the camp of those big producers to restore that trust. I don't think the ball is on the consumers to have blind trust, but you see what I mean? And it's all in the consumer, you know, prerogative to choose what they want to eat.
Dominique Brossard is professor and chair of the Department of Life Sciences and Communication at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She was also instrumental in putting together the genetically modified crops report. She's a member of the National Academies of Science. This is the opening bell. It's 529.
From ABC News Tech Trends, I'm Alex Stone, taking your workout from dumb to smart. There are smartphones, smart TVs, smart watches, and now smart dumbbells. The folks at Bowflex say using a smart dumbbell can improve your weightlifting.
It is not only going to track the weight you lift, how much weight you lift, total weight, calories burned, and it's going to make sure you do that correctly.
Tom Holland is a Bowflex fitness advisor. He says an app links to the dumbbells, offering up different workouts. And he says doing it correctly is key, that many people don't lift correctly when working out.
I'm going to do a bicep curl. And it's going to gauge based on that first bicep curl. It's going to count my rep. And now from here on out, I have to do a full repetition or it won't give me credit.
The system costs about $500. It comes with 5 to 60 pounds, but if you need more weight...
If you're a guy who says, I need more, you can actually add on for a couple $100, make it up to 100 pounds.
With Tech Trends, I'm Alex Stone, ABC News.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is the opening bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning. Welcome back to the program. It's 5:40. Apparently, somebody in Washington is listening to Illinois U.S. Senator Dick Durbin and to you, all of the people grumbling in the TSA lines at Chicago's airports. Yesterday, as flyers were waiting in lines as long as 3 hours long at O'Hare and Midway, Illinois U.S. Senator Dick Durbin, appearing on the WGN Steve Cochran Show, talked about his concern about whether or not things might actually degrade into riots at the airports. Yesterday, the TSA director, Peter Neffinger, actually sent more TSA agents to Chicago. Let's get an update first, though, on the pre-check lines. Yesterday, we sent Ryan Burrow, WGN's Ryan Burrow, over to see what those were like because the TSA has been telling people to get pre-check. And this is what he found out.
For those with appointments,
she scanned my passport, did my fingerprints, checked all the information, done.
But for those without,
I thought maybe I'd wait 2 hours. I never expected to be here more than, I mean, I'm going to be here for at least 4 hours.
It got so crowded just an hour after opening, the enrollment center here in Chicago closed to walk-ups.
They're telling me they don't take walk-ins, so.
Those who managed to get in waited more than 3 hours.
She told me 3 hours when I got here, so it was 3 hours.
Your first appointment wasn't until mid-June, so We were hoping to get something sooner than that. I ran into issues a couple weeks ago at Myrtle Beach, of all places. It was over a two-hour wait there. Small airport.
Appointments for some locations are booked solid for weeks, even months. Ryan Burrow, WGN News.
Last evening at an event, the TSA director, Peter Neffringer, actually apologized to the people of Chicago.
I always tell people I won't apologize for doing our job well, but I do apologize to the people who found themselves stranded in Chicago yesterday.
And those people the other night at O'Hare stranded after they missed their airlines. Let's bring in our airline expert this morning from Dallas, Rick Cini, who's the co-founder and CEO of faircompare.com and is with us regularly to talk about this. Rick, I have to ask, this seems like a perfect storm, but what's coming together, and have you been able to figure out what are the ingredients that have caused this?
Well, you had a couple things. First of all, you have a bunch of passengers that are flying this summer that didn't fly last summer, about a 6% increase. A lot of that's because ticket prices haven't raised too much. They've been pretty flat, and in some cities like Chicago, they've actually been cheaper. So you've got more passengers. At the same time, TSA actually expected a bunch of people to sign up for TSA PreCheck, which is basically pre-9/11, shoes on, metal detector, liquids in the bag, computers in the bag, screening, which can put people through the airport twice as fast through security is normal mechanism, but only about 8.5 or 9 million signed up instead of 25 million. Because of that, over the last 3 or 4 years, they've actually let go 4,500 or so screeners, but they needed those screeners. So now they're frantically trying to get those screeners back, as well as every month there's hundreds, if not thousands, of screeners that are drop off the workforce because of how difficult the job is.
And this morning we're hearing that, too, the pre-check here, at least in Chicago, there's a long wait for that. Not only is there a waiting period to get an appointment, but once you get an appointment, there's a wait for that. So even that is backed up.
Yeah, so what you had is at least a couple of years where there was hardly anybody, people signing up for PreCheck. It was very popular initially. Now that everybody is seeing these long lines and on the news, they're all trying to sign up for PreCheck, and now you can't get an actual appointment for several months. And this is part of the problem, is you don't know it until you have the issue. And for those of us like I actually was one of the first few people to go through PreCheck and go through enhanced screening, but it's one of the best programs out there. My daughter's had it since she was 8 years old, so you can actually get it for your entire family. If you fly more than once a year, PreCheck is something you need to look into.
When it works, though, because we're also hearing stories about that there are lines for that as well. One of the instances was the Indianapolis airport, as an example, has security dogs, more dogs than Chicago, and those dogs are helping, sniff people and getting them through PreCheck faster. But even that's not a sure bet, is it?
No, not at all. I mean, PreCheck doesn't mean that you'll get through. In fact, I've been to the airport many times when the PreCheck lanes were closed. They close them at certain times of day. They don't have them. If they can't staff the normal lines, they're trying to move their people from place to place, trying to figure it out. So it can be lengthy lines as well. It's pretty simple. I think what they want to do is they want to get these 25 million people signed up for PreCheck. If they made it free, I think they would have gotten a lot more people signing up, and they can actually screen people. There's no way that senators calling for bag fees to go away is going to happen. Airlines aren't going to be dumping $3 billion in revenue a year. It's just not going to happen.
Last time we talked, you said there might be some indication this might be given away. Is that something you're still hearing?
I think that's probably the best way to get people to sign up for this type of program is to give it away at no cost. They try to do that. They were picking people, as you noted. If you're in the normal line and they have dogs at the airport, if the dogs have sort of pre-screened you, they can move you over to the PreCheck line. They tried to do this over the last couple of years, and some people got through the cracks. At least one convicted domestic terrorist made it through TSA PreCheck by being removed randomly from the line. This is something they can't afford to happen.
There is growing indication that this is all sort of mismanagement by the TSA. First, the cutting of the staff, the prediction of the PreCheck. Do you think the TSA director is going to have to resign over this?
I don't think he'll have to resign necessarily, but they're going to have to address it more quickly. This is not something that just happened to happen in the last week or two. The alarm bells were ringing several months ago, and they just can't react fast enough. There's 2 million passengers each day that go through security. It's an important job. All it takes is one to get through, and they have to sort this out. They're going to have to allow airports and airlines to have private screeners in some cases.
Get us out of town for a free or cheap fare.
Yeah, for summertime, late June, I would be heading toward the Seattle area, for example. You have Seattle at 220 round trip, Vancouver at 290 round trip. Those are great deals. South Florida, under 200, Miami and Fort Lauderdale. Those are your two best bets. Go north or go south.
And if you have a lot of bags, just try to walk. You might get there faster.
If you have three-hour lines at TSA, it may be faster to walk.
Rick Cini from faircompare.com with us this morning at faircompare.com and at Rick Cini about the problems at O'Hare and Midway. By the way, U.S. Senator Mark Kirk yesterday said that if problems don't improve at the TSA, that the TSA director should resign by Memorial Day.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
5:51 on the WGN Market Desk this morning. From the Market Desk, Dow futures are pointing lower this morning. The Dow futures off about 11. S&P and NASDAQ futures lower as well. Let's get the latest on commodities this morning. And good morning, Orion Samuelson.
Steve, good morning. When I talked to two traders on the trading floor at the Board of Trade yesterday and said, what's going on? I got a one-word answer and a three-word answer. First trader said, funds. Second trader said, funds are buying. But soybeans jumped yesterday as investors took money into commodities, maybe out of stocks. Commodity funds, net buyers of up to 14,000 corn contracts and 11,000 soybean contracts. That helped lift the nearby soy futures contract to its highest price since November of 2014. At the end of the day yesterday, the July soybean contract was up 16 cents a bushel. July corn was up 3¾, and wheat, not a bad day, up 7¼ cents. Mercantile Exchange live cattle futures edged higher, helped again by technical buying and short covering. And at the end of the day, the August live cattle contract was up 27 cents. The August feeder cattle contract up 97 cents. And the nearby June lean hog contract was down 40 cents, but the rest of the months ended higher. Monsanto continues to make news this week. Monsanto said today it would, or yesterday, it would suspend future soybean technologies in Argentina, a move that could limit output of the country's main cash crop after a disagreement with the government over inspections of genetically modified soybeans. Have a good day. I'm Orion Samuelson.
Thanks, Orion. 5:53 now, the opening bell continues. Last night in Chicago, hundreds of people filled city council chambers to voice opposition to Mayor Emanuel's plan to regulate online home rental platforms like Airbnb. There were also some who support the mayor who don't think his rules go far enough to curb sometimes loud and drunken parties and other problems that some of these property investors have created in neighborhoods, fancier neighborhoods, from what some are calling de facto hotels. This all comes as a new Pew study out today takes an in-depth look at the share economy and how Americans feel about the fast-growing industry. Its biggest companies include tech giants like Uber, Airbnb, GoFundMe. Aaron Smith is an associate director at the Pew Research Center. He says many users tend to agree with the feeling that some of these things are problems, that there are weird regulations, that there are also some sort of weird relationships with contractors. Here's some of the findings.
At the same time, when you really press them on some day-to-day examples of expectations that they might have, they really see those services and expect those services to play a detailed role in managing various aspects of the customer process.
He says, well, over 90% of frequent users are closely following how the industry is regulated, something we saw last night here in Chicago.
By about a 2-to-1 margin, they feel that those services should not have to follow the existing rules and regulations that govern the existing taxi market. If you look at non-users, on the other hand, they're much more evenly split.
Speaking there about Uber, he says men and women seem to donate to crowdfunding projects differently. The other part of the survey is how those aspects of the shared economy are working. Women more frequently donate to charitable causes.
Men tend to donate to a larger number of projects. They're more likely to make larger contributions, and they're much more likely to donate to fund new projects or inventions, you know, new gadgets, new tools, new geeky stuff.
The Pew Research Center study also finds what you probably would guess, that the industry's best customers are in urban areas and not in country areas of the U.S.
People who live in urban areas, relatively affluent, relatively young.
The research out today about the shared economy. There is more news today about the Fed. The Federal Reserve, ahead of releasing its minutes today, stirred up Wall Street yesterday. We'll be interested to see whether or not they're moving toward a potential rate increase in June. Also, this is what the TV network industry is calling Upfront Week. It's when all of the TV networks put together their best foot forward for advertisers to show off the fall schedule. There are some winners and losers emerging, according to some analysts. One of them appears to be ESPN, which is in a lot of trouble. Yesterday, they announced that they were moving forward with more online offerings. They're going to use more media sources like your mobile phones and your smartphones. Also yesterday, we heard from NBC and Comcast about what they're planning to do. They're actually working on an advertising plan that gets advertisers more involved ahead of the season. They've already got commitments from several of the big mobile companies like Verizon, also Sony and PlayStation. Hulu is also heavy into this. The presentations continue today. NBC presents again. CBS presents tomorrow. These are the upfronts in New York about the fall schedule coming up. That is the opening bell for today. The Steve Cochran Show is coming up next. We'll continue to follow your money throughout the morning here on 720 WGN. Have a great day. Our producer is Mary Sandberg, Bennett Wakenight, our production assistant. Also, our engineer this morning is Ben Cortez.